The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Walter Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading the February 2026 issue. We begin with Grounded in History. Latta University Historic Park honors the past while inspiring the future, by Susanna Klingenberg. Tucked just off Oberlin Road, beyond the hum of the village district, lies a pocket of green that holds echoes of another time. Opened in 2024, the 2 acres of Latta University Historic Park have become a neighborhood gathering spot. But the space also holds a nearly forgotten chapter of Raleigh's past, a story of resilience, ambition, and the complicated layers of Southern history. Latta University Historic Park was once a bustling part of Oberlin Village, Raleigh's largest and longest-serving freedmen's village. A map of the area from the 1860s shows roads named Emancipation Alley and Lincoln Avenue, and in its heyday, Oberlin Village stretched across 149 acres with 170 families who built farms and shops, churches and businesses, a school, and a cemetery. Especially in its earliest days, Oberlin Village was something rare and powerful, a place of safety, opportunity, and abundance in a world that made freedom hard to hold on to. It was into that atmosphere in the late 1800s that Reverend M. L. Latta emerged. Born into slavery on one of the Cameron family plantations, Latta's childhood was shaped by struggle. After his father and elder brother died, Latta was responsible for helping raise his 11 siblings. In his autobiography, Latta says whippings were frequent and food was scarce. Quote, "I would be just as hungry when I got through eating as I was when I commenced," end quote. Latta attended school on and off, balancing studies with heavy work responsibilities. He enrolled at Shaw University at age 15 with, according to his autobiography, 10 cents in my pocket. He worked odd jobs to pay his tuition and board, eventually earning a teaching certificate. For Latta, education was more than self-advancement. It was a pathway for progress. It was in that spirit that in 1892, he founded Latta University, a coeducational school for formerly enslaved people and their children, on the space that's now Latta University Historic Park. Unlike today's four-year universities, Latta University was modeled more closely on Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute, explains Doug Porter, City of Raleigh Program Director for Historic Sites. According to Porter, students at Latta University studied vocations and trades such as blacksmithing, bricklaying, and wheelwrighting, alongside academic subjects like physics and Latin for those planning to become teachers or pursue higher education. It even included a kindergarten for orphans and children of formerly enslaved parents. At its height, the university boasted 26 buildings and hundreds of students. Latta became an advocate for the education of formerly enslaved people, and the university survived nearly entirely on donations. He traveled across the United States and abroad. In his autobiography, Latta even recounted a meeting with Queen Victoria. But history is rarely tidy, and Latta's legacy is no exception. His self-published biography is considered a mix of truth and fiction. Newspaper articles from the time indicate that some Oberlin residents distanced themselves from Latta. He was also accused of misrepresenting the university and embezzling money. His tarnished reputation and mismanagement of funds hastened the university's decline. By 1922, Latta University was shuttered, The land was sold, and the buildings began falling into disrepair. Over the years, the campus was consumed by fire and development. The final surviving building from the university, the Latta family home, burned down in 2007. For years afterward, the university largely faded from memory. When the land that is now Latta University Historic Park was deeded to the city, advocates rallied to ensure its history was not erased by development. As an African American, it's pretty unusual to be able to trace family history back that far, says Brandy Newworth, Latta's great-great-granddaughter. It's given me a sense of responsibility for the land, that it continues to help people. Newworth served on the Citizens Planning Committee for the park. The group also included historians, planning experts, neighbors, and individuals with a first-hand connection to the park, as well as representatives from the nonprofits Friends of Oberlin Village and Latta House Foundation. We go into the community engagement phase of planning with a pretty blank slate, says Emma Lyles, City of Raleigh Capital Project Manager, who led the committee. We wanted to honor the history we couldn't see anymore in the physical space. The planning process sparked debate over how best to tell Latta's story, but over time, two priorities emerged: preserve the history of the land and preserve its serenity. On the two-acre site, visitors today can trace the Latta House footprint in granite. Six interpretive signs, developed with input from Newworth and local historians, highlight artifacts like family photos, census records, and findings from archaeological digs, including slate and writing tools, cutlery, and coins. Plans for a second phase include an interpretive pavilion to explore the university's story more deeply. Newworth believes the park now captures the spirit of her ancestors' mission. Quote, "We wanted it to tell the story, but we also wanted it to serve the community, because that was really the point of Latta University. And I think it does that," end quote. From the Nature Department, the soul of a tree, Appreciating Nature's Silhouettes in Winter, by Mike Dunn. Many people I know dislike the winter months. Perhaps it's the cold, the lack of green, or the short days that make them yearn for spring in all its glory. But I find winter to be a special time, when I tend to pay more attention to things that have been supplanted the rest of the year by the myriad wildflowers, insects, and wildlife in our woods. I particularly like to pay attention to the winter trees and notice the distinctive outlines and branching patterns of our common species. There are many factors that determine the basic growth form of a tree: genetics, soil type, moisture, age, and competition from other trees, to name a few. Some field guides out there include stylized tree silhouettes as a way to help you identify them. Those shapes are generally for trees that are isolated on the landscape, not the ones you would typically see around here in a forest or backyard setting, where a tree must compete with its neighbors for sunlight and nutrients. But on my winter trips to eastern North Carolina to view the wintering waterfowl, a frequent delight is seeing the stark outlines of countless trees on that flat and wide-open landscape. The bald cypress is the iconic tree of this area's swamps and lowlands, particularly because of the buttressed base of the trunk with the knees, the upward extensions of the root system. For many years, I was one of the judges for Wildlife in North Carolina magazine's annual photo competition. A line of bald cypress trees in Lake Matamuskeet was a frequent entry in the landscape category. I think every visitor to the lake stops to photograph this group of trees, which is especially impressive at sunrise. And I've often stopped to wonder at the beauty of a lone bald cypress on Lake Matamuskeet on calm evenings when the still waters create its mirror image. One of my favorite silhouette photos that I've taken was of trees reflected in the black waters along the lake's boardwalk. Many years ago, this was one of several prints that were for sale at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Almost every time I went in, someone had turned the photo upside down, thinking it was supposed to be looking up instead of down into the dark water. I've also seen some breathtaking trees on trips to see the elk in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. One morning, I found a large walnut tree in Cataloochee Valley, alongside a meadow that serves as a gathering place for the elk that reside in our mountains. The heavy frost created an icy texture to the tree limbs and grasses. Another time, driving out of Cades Cove at sunset, I came across a magnificent tree out in a field along the road. The almost perfect symmetry of its branching pattern suggested that this tree had lived its life out in the open, perhaps as the only tree at the edge of a farmer's field. I frequently stop along the roadside and snap a picture of a noteworthy tree. I rarely can get out to confirm its identity, but I don't think you necessarily need to attach a name to something to appreciate it. This winter, take some time to look for tree silhouettes in your area, whether it's a single oak along a city street or an old-growth pine on a hike nearby. Notice the branching pattern, the shape of the crown, and the straightness or curvature of the trunk. Look up and appreciate how it creates a unique connection between the earth and the winter sky. One of my favorite photos is of a huge tulip poplar that towers above all its neighbors on our property in Chatham County. After a February storm, the snow highlighted its branches against a crisp blue sky. To see a tree in winter, its branches bare, is to see the soul of that tree. Andrew Wyeth, the famous American painter, expressed a similar sentiment. Quote, "I prefer winter and fall, when you feel the bone structure in the landscape," end quote. Bone structure, skeleton, or soul, however it resonates with you, a winter tree's silhouette can be a thing of beauty. From the Archives Department, Coffins and Cabinets, The Surprising Evolution of Our Oldest Business, by Ian F.G. Dunn. There's a photograph from the State Archives of North Carolina of a horse-drawn hearse belonging to H.J. Brown Coffin House on the 100 block of West Harget Street in 1910. The photographer of this image had their back to the funeral home's headquarters, which is now the high-end restaurant Death and Taxes. H.J. Brown Coffin House, now the Brown Wynn Funeral Home, is Raleigh's oldest continually run business. The company namesake, Henry Jerome Brown, was born in Virginia in 1811 and came to Raleigh with his family in 1816. After learning woodworking from his father, he established a business manufacturing furniture in 1836. By 1854, Brown was providing funeral services and hand-built coffins in addition to making furniture, a common industry overlap in the 19th century. An 1854 advertisement in the Raleigh Semi-Weekly Standard read, quote, coffin making. He has provided himself with a new and handsome hearse and is prepared to manufacture coffins of every description, of mahogany, walnut, or more common wood. The patronage of the public respectfully solicited. End quote. After the difficult years of Reconstruction, the business flourished, and upon H.J. Brown's death in 1879, his son John Wesley Brown took the reins. He continued to grow the business, moving away from handcrafted caskets to wholesale units. In 1907, a purpose-built three-story brick building in the classic Revival style was constructed on the southwest corner of Harget and Salisbury Streets. This new facility, where Death and Taxes sits now, was advanced for the time and featured electric lighting, a heating plant, and even an elevator. In 1914, the business passed into the hands of John's son, Fabius, or Fabe, Porter Brown. Under his leadership, the business matured and advanced alongside changes in funerary trends and technology, all while weathering the 1918 influenza epidemic, World War I, and the Great Depression. After Fabe's unexpected death in 1940, his nephew, Robert Webb Wynn, Jr., purchased the business. It was renamed Brown Wynn Funeral Home, and in 1954 moved to its present-day location on St. Mary Street. Looking back at the photograph, next to the hearse is a business. This small building was occupied by Raleigh Art Company, a short-lived business offering picture framing and wallpaper hanging services. This clue helped greatly in dating the photograph. In the background, a rare view of the 1887 Raleigh Water Tower on Morgan Street, complete with its 100,000-gallon iron tank. The man in the photograph standing beside the hearse is thought to be Thomas Holloway, the only hearse driver employed by H.J. Brown between 1900 and 1912. Affectionately known by scores of Raleighites as Monk, he was known for his jolly demeanor and love of children and horses. Upon his death in 1912, local newspapers lauded him as a man of few faults, but one was tardiness. So often he'd stop and chat that it permitted time to flash by him. The days of horse-drawn hearses ended soon after Monk's death, when the company began employing motorized hearses in 1915. Brown Wynn continues to operate in Raleigh from its main location on St. Mary Street. From the garden section, love and longevity. Cupid struck me again. I'll keep my husband for another year. This month makes 38. I would commit for longer, but he doesn't help me in the garden. In the early stages of my gardening journey, I happily took on high-maintenance projects. But as time passed, kids, work, caring for elderly parents, and my own aches and pains have made it harder to prioritize. But I won't give up. Here are a few ways to garden smarter, not harder, by Helen Yost. First, swap in the right shrubs. If you have to prune your shrubs to fit your space, then they're planted in the wrong place, unless it's a shrub designed for annual pruning, such as a boxwood hedge. Dwarf varieties of shrubs can offer year-round interest in your yard and feed the wildlife, even with limited space. For full sun or part shade, try native dwarf yaupinholly, viburnum, or fothergilla. For total shade, I like distillium, sweetbox, or poet's laurel. Second, plant low-maintenance ground covers. Ground covers can serve as a living mulch and add a green layer of life year-round. For the sun, consider creeping juniper, creeping raspberry, or sedum succulents like hens and chicks, a drought-hardy, cold-tolerant perennial. For shade, and in honor of Valentine's Day, consider bleeding hearts, named so for its heart-shaped flowers, or epimediums, or wild ginger, which both have heart-shaped leaves. Lastly, add no-fuss ephemerals. I love finding late-winter ephemerals, the wildflowers that bloom first in our landscape, for they offer a glimpse of forthcoming spring. Most are shade-loving and prefer moist woodland settings, such as bloodroot and hepatica. For sun, my favorites are galanthus, crocus, and daffodil. This month, you can also plant trout lily bulbs, another favorite ephemeral, which will bloom in early spring. From the endnote, Some Like It Hot, Learning to Love a Little Spice by Kelly Fletcher. I grew up in a spice-averse household. My mom once bit into a green bell pepper and shrieked that her lip was blistering and needed ice. Growing up in North Carolina, I'd seen Texas Pete on the table at every barbecue joint and seafood shack we visited, but I never touched the stuff. "It'll burn your taste buds off," or "it'll make a hole in your stomach," my mom warned. Our pantry's most daring condiment? McCormick's ground black pepper. Then one fateful morning in middle school, my sister urged me to grab that yellow and red bottle instead of the ketchup at the Bojangles. I doused my chicken biscuit with vinegary, peppery goodness, and it was love at first bite. From that moment on, I've taken the opposite approach as my mother, putting hot sauce on everything from eggs and cheeseburgers to cottage cheese and salads, which is how I found my adult self with not one, but two refrigerator shelves dedicated to hot sauce of varying heat levels and flavor profiles. Through years of trial and error, each has earned its own specific applications. Texas Pete goes on bacon, egg, and cheese sandwiches, and in New England, clam chowder. Crystal is my go-to for fried chicken biscuits, muffalettas, and chicken soup. Valentina is for breakfast burritos and taco salads. Goya is reserved for rice and beans. Sriracha, sambal oleg, and chili crisp adorn every dish of stir-fry, pho, ramen and dumplings. Tabasco is only for Bloody Marys or emergencies. About 5 years ago, my husband grabbed the wrong bottle for our taco salad. "Can you swap the Texas Pete for the Valentina?" I asked. He looked genuinely confused. "What's the difference?" I spun around so fast, I should have gotten whiplash. "What's the difference?" I repeated, my eyes wide. "Do you really think you can tell the difference between all these hot sauces in the fridge?" he asked. 100%, I said without blinking. "All right, then, blind taste test." He rallied 7 spoons and began extracting bottles from the fridge. I left the room, returned wearing a sleep mask, and sat down for the challenge. What followed was a flawless performance, correctly naming spoonful after spoonful. After 15 years together, not much surprised him anymore, but this did. "How?" he asked. I launched into a 20-minute TED Talk about the nuances of every bottle in our fridge, and several that weren't there but deserved honorable mention, as well as the aforementioned pairings. A lawyer by profession, he's well practiced in arguing a position, but was a little surprised to see me so passionately do the same about the contents of glass bottles. Funny how love and devotion for the unfamiliar build over time. My refrigerator shelves are a testament to that. So is my marriage to a man who has always cared enough to listen and respect my preferences, however silly they might seem to others. These days, my husband knows exactly which bottle to grab based on the meal. He's even developed his own opinions, often leaning towards Texas Pete over Crystal. My mom still won't touch the stuff, but I'm proud to report that my stomach lining, taste buds, and marriage are still intact. From the calendar, college basketball. We're in the middle of college basketball season, which is especially exciting here in the Triangle, where we have three major universities with ACC teams. This month offers several opportunities to see games between our local rivals. The UNC men's team will play NC State in the Lenovo Center on February 17th at 7 p.m. It's the only time you'll see these two teams play each other this regular season. The first time in more than a century that the teams haven't battled twice. Visit gopack.com for more information. On view at the Gregg Museum of Art and Design all this month at NC State's campus is the exhibition Words Equal Power. It features writings by North Carolina poet laureate Jackie Shelton Green, paired with visual works by both students and professional artists. Collectively, the exhibit explores how art can spark change in the world and encourage compassion and strength in communities. Join Green on February 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. for a Q&A and artist talk to discuss the exhibition. The event is free, but registration is required. Visit calendar.ncsu.edu for more information. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.